whenever someone studies them, they're usually considered as cylinders, tapered, twisted, anything, but their cross-section is usually assumed to be circular. And there is a good reason for that. I mean, it's mathematically simple. It makes equations simpler. It's simpler to describe. But there is really no physical reason to do this. In fact, if you think of a magnetic field in the sense of the mapping it provides between one surface and then the other surface, this mapping is not, in general, shape-conserving. And this is a picture from Slava Titov, who acknowledged that and introduced a quantity that he calls quashing factor, which is, let's say that a small circle on one surface gets mapped to twisted to an ellipse somewhere else, and if we consider, say, the eccentricity of this ellipse, and if one circle is one foot point and the ellipse is the other foot point, then this quantity is commonly referred to as quashing factor. And it is not, in general, one. So a circle does not, in general, map into a circle from a foot point to a foot point. But then the same must be true between, in general, between any two segments of a flux tube. For example, from foot point to a loop apex, or from a loop apex to a foot point, for example. But then the question is, how strong is this effect, and why is this important? So this talk is to advertise a paper that has been recently accepted in UPJ, and it has much more details that I will show you, that I will show you here. But okay, let's talk about mapping. So let's think of, okay, so we all know that magnetic field lines expand with height. The question is, how do they expand with width? What I did here is, this is a simple potential dipole field. I initiated four field lines from a square. And so I essentially constructed a flux tube that has a square cross-section at the base. And it got mapped to somewhat squarish cross-section at the apex. Or if you just take the slice of all flux tubes in this field at their apices, you would get cross-sections that would look like that. So again, I just paved all the foot points with circles, and I just looked at what with squares. I just looked at what a square grid maps into in the corona. Well, that doesn't look too bad, but things stop looking so innocent as soon as you deviate from a simple dipole topology. Here, for example, is an arcade. Again, I played the same game. I initiated four field lines from a square at the lower boundary. And this is what the apex of such a flux tube looks like. And it makes a lot of sense. If you think about it, because of the translation symmetry, flux ropes in an arcade cannot expand sidewards. But the field drops with height, so they have to expand somewhere. Well, this is what more of them look like. Oh, and you can see some boundary effects closer to the edge. That's because my arcade was finite. In fact, the length of this arcade was comparable to the separation between the polarities. But anyway, you can see how different are those cross sections. Things get even more fun if you make your topology just a little bit more complicated. For example, if you consider a dipole and an arcade, all potential field, the bases of both of those flux ropes are circles at the lower boundary. This is what their cross sections look like. First, they're distorted from a square. And second, they're distorted by a different amount and in different direction. In fact, if you take a cross section again through the middle vertical plane, this is more or less the picture that you would see. So the point that I would like to make with this slide is that the cross-sectional area of a flux tube may change dramatically, for example, from a foot point to an apex. Secondly, such a shape distortion would depend dramatically on the configuration of at the lower boundary, on the configuration of the field. And thirdly, just one flux rope would not be representative of one field because, again, the properties of distortion vary greatly throughout the same domain. But so as I said, we cannot just select one flux rope and study it and then generalize. We need some sort of a statistical approach. So I tried to make one, and let me explain you what is going on here. So I took an HMI magnetogram. I computed potential field in a box. And again, so this is my box. Updated it. This is my box. And on the lower boundary, there's a magnetogram. You can see the positive polarity. And you will see the negative polarity in just a second. This is the negative polarity. So I played pretty much the same game, except that I tiled the lower boundary with hexagons. From the corners of these hexagons, I initiated field lines. And essentially, I created a set, essentially, I sliced the entire volume into flux ropes with realistic cross section, with hexagonal cross sections at the lower boundary. And I just looked at what do those hexagons at the lower boundary map to at the apices. And let me show you. This is what cross-section of coronal loops looks like if their foot points are circular or are regular hexagons. Now the question is, how many regular hexagons can you see on this image? Well, little to none, honestly. Well, no, I take it back, there are some, but they definitely do not form the majority. So what I did next, I did some statistics. So I said, well, let's fit an ellipse into each hexagon and look at the major axis, minor axis, the ratio, et cetera, the expansion. So this is it. And now if we are to study the expansion normally, assuming that this cross-section is circular, they would say, well, the flux is conserved, so the magnetic field times the area is constant, and magnetic field drops, so the radius is square root, et cetera. So this is what the expansion would look like if we were to use this approach, is that black curve over here. And if I calculate precisely what the cross-section is, and this is what the two axes of the ellipses look like. And below is some data. So you can see that the distributions are highly skewed. So I'm showing not only the peak, but also the median and full width at half max. So the base radius was half a pixel. And you can see that if we were to use traditional approach, we would say that, well, the median of the expansion is maybe a factor of 5. But in reality, they expand in a highly non-uniform manner. And in one dimension, they only expand by a factor of 3 at most, and in the other one, over a factor of 10. Now, what consequences does it have? Well, in fact, it may have a very big consequences for what we think we measure when we look, for what we think we measure when we study coronal loops. And I'm just going to show you some examples. First of all, there would be a selection bias. The orientation, so there will be a selection bias that would make us preferentially select for studies the coronal loops that are oriented in a certain way to the line of sight. And here is one example. Suppose that we're looking at the same ellipse, edge on and sidewards. Of course, when we're looking at it edge on, it will be thinner, but also the column depth would be bigger, and therefore it will appear brighter, even though it is the same structure. And of course, brighter structure is more likely to be selected, especially for the study. But if you're looking at it edge on, this is when it would expand less. So this is just one example from that field that I just showed you. I selected two flux ropes, again with hexagonal cross sections, close by of similar shape, similar flux, with the aspect ratio at the apex within full width at half max. So I have no reasons to assume that there's something unusual about them. And I rendered them in several projections. And by rendered, I mean I just filled them with a hydrostatic isothermal atmosphere, and this is just an integrated intensity along the line of sight. So it's essentially density squared integrated along the line of sight. When viewed from the top and when viewed from the side, those are two loops, those are the same two flux tubes. And the same flux tube on each frame is marked with the same symbol. So Imagine that an observer is unaware of this effect, and someone gave you, for example, two stereo images that are 90 degrees apart, say those two images. First of all, if you're unaware of this shape distortion, you would be likely to say, well, this thick and faint loop, and this thin and brighter is this thin and bright. Well, in reality, this is not the case. So this is one thing. So this thin and bright loop is this thick and dim loop in the other projection. Oh, and the grayscale is the same, and the pressure scale height is the same. So everything is... the second issue would be, suppose that we wish to study the expansion or the diameter, say, in this projection, and suppose that there is a background. Which of the two loops would we be more likely to select for study? Well, the one that is brighter, the one that is crisper, but it will also be the one that would expand less with height. And in the paper that just got accepted, there is a lot of analysis of these images. So what I would like to show is an ensemble of such synthetic loops. And it nicely demonstrates this effect I'm talking about, the selection effect. You can see a crisp, thin, bright, non-expanded loops. And I'm afraid on this screen you can barely see some other loops that are faint and which actually do expand with height. Another thing to notice is the flat loop tops. When we're looking at the edges of those ribbons, you can see those elongated brightenings. So this is just an example of what it may look like. Again, this is just one consequence. The other consequence is that, the other consequence is that the loops, depending on their orientation to the line of sight, they may appear to be over-dense or under-dense. And here's what I mean by that. Imagine that, I'm just following the standard approach. Imagine that we have a column of plasma, hydrostatic plasma, so the density drops exponentially with height. And if the column depth doesn't change, then the intensity, the emission measure, if the plasma is isothermal, is just proportional to density squared. So ideally, we can just measure how the intensity drops with height and derive the density from that, for example. But then, of course, if the flux tube expands with height, then the power law for the emission measure as a function of z would be slightly different, because we would have to account for the column depth. But still, from here, using some simple models, we still can try to derive the density. It turns out in some studies that loops appear to be over-dense. And one of the explanations was, for example, Craig DeForest proposed that maybe loops do expand, but they are so thin that they do not expand in... they do stay confined within one pixel of our CCD resolution. In this case, you do some math and you get a slightly better power law. Then here's the thing. Suppose that we have a loop that expands in one direction only. And let's consider two cases. We're looking at it edge on, and we're looking at it flat face on. So it turns out that you would come up with two different power laws for how density drops with height. So if this all is correct, then if we're looking at the sun on the limb, what we will see is a superposition of thin, crisp, over-dense loops and dim fuzz that would appear under-dense. So, what I said, and I believe this is my last slide. So, the other implications that I would just like to briefly mention is if we do not know how anisotropic is the expansion with height, we cannot really lay constraint on the size of the foot point. We cannot say that, for example, loop has this width at the apex, so it must be that much smaller at the foot point. No, this is not necessarily the case. It may just expand in one direction preferentially. And also, in some MHD simulations, for example, Gudiksen and Nordlund mentioned that when they propagate a circle throughout the magnetic field, the edges of the circle may become wrinkled. And these wrinkles may provide, for example, the line of sight depth variations that would appear to be loops. And they would appear to resolve into finer and finer structures as the resolution of our instruments increase. So here I stop and take questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Do we have a question? I think it's very nice to go back to some basics and try and understand what we're looking at in terms of the underlying structure, which you've done very nicely. There is another aspect another piece of work related to this that I've done, talking about the interpretation of spicules in terms of not a squashed oval, but a sheet-like structure, very similar kind of geometric argument. The only point I wanted to make, though, was that the observations where you see the most loops on the sun are around active regions. In active regions, the photospheric boundary conditions are river-like. They're not flux tube-like. They're much more like ribbons of flux in the intergranular lanes. So the idea of just because we see a loop over an active region, it therefore is, you know, a quasi-cylindrical. I think you're very right to question that. It's puzzled me for a long time as to why we should see those things, given that photospheric boundary conditions are not at all look like a cylindrical flux tube.
Okay, so my question is on, I think first slide you mentioned that you related shape of QSL with the shape of flux rope. And I think you can have circular flux rope with QSL looking quite different from it. So they shouldn't be related with each other directly. And then other quick comment was, if you're just taking potential field, then you can always extrapolate your foot point, which is non-circular. But if you assume any current flowing through it, then we know that if you're far away from the foot point, it will try to relax to a geometry which is either elliptical or circular, unless it's driven by any other external event. But you have to consider the effect that in your flux rope there are net current.
And the currents may distort the shape. Of course, it has to be investigated. But for example, in my preliminary experiments, yes, they distort the shape and they make this effect worse. And if you think of QSLs, cool loop funds tend to form at QSLs, right? And those are known to be flat and wide. So I expect that this effect would only be stronger if we introduce currents in general. But of course, we need to do more research on that.
Anyway, you can talk about this.